Welcome, everyone, to the third live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. My name is Christy Peoples. I'm a producer here at Sounds True, and I'll be your host. Today, Dr. Kelly McGonigal will be teaching on the neuroscience of change. She's broadcasting live from Palo Alto, California, while the Sounds True team and I are here in our Boulder studios. A free recording of this session will remain accessible for 24 hours, and if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, to transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Kelly McGonigal. Kelly McGonigal, PhD, is a health psychologist and lecturer at Stanford University. As a pioneer in the field of science help, her mission is to translate insights from psychology and neuroscience into practical strategies that support personal well-being and strengthen communities. Through the Stanford Center for Compassion and Altruism, she co-authored the Stanford Compassion Cultivation Training and studies how mindfulness, compassion, and self-compassion can promote health, happiness, and resilience. She's the author of several books, including the international bestseller The Willpower Instinct and her latest book, The Upside of Stress. Welcome, Kelly.
Hi, it's so great to be here and to be live. Live from Palo Alto with a cat on my lap. So if you hear or see anything funny, just attribute it to the cat who is currently on my lap. And I'm really excited today to share some very new research on the neuroscience of change and how that neuroscience can really help you with whatever type of change that you're making. So I wanted to start by actually asking you to think about a change that you would like to make that maybe you're struggling with. It could be a goal, a habit that you're trying to change, something you want to put your energy and attention toward, some vision that you have for your life or for yourself. And as we go through this new science, I'll be pausing every now and then to invite you to reflect on how it might apply to that change. So I think it'll be really helpful if you can actually identify something. And I'm going to share with you an example from my life, one of the most difficult changes that I've made as we go through, so you can see how it applied, at least in my own life. And the example I'm going to use, it was a very difficult change that took many years to work through, and that was overcoming a fear of flying, that was beyond the sort of the normal, oh, I don't like to fly, but sort of one of those very gripping phobias that controls your life. And even during the period of my life where for several years I refused to fly, it still seemed to control my life. I would have nightmares about flying. And so I'll talk to you about how the ideas that we'll explore today helped me overcome that fear. And just to sort of set it up, you know, what that fear really was, is there was a part of me who didn't like how it felt to be on an airplane, didn't like to be trapped or out of control, had memories and fantasies that were related to fear that would sort of come up every time I even thought about flying, let alone get on a plane. And there was part of me that just didn't want to deal with that, wanted to protect myself from those thoughts and those feelings and those experiences. And there was another part of me who really wanted to be able to see my family when I needed to stay connected to family members I had on both sides of the United States, wanted to be able to take professional opportunities that required getting on an airplane. There's part of me that wanted to be able to see the world and revisit places I had lived that I hadn't seen in a while to have a kind of freedom. And when you think about that type of change I was trying to make to overcome that fear, or if you think about the type of change that you are aspiring toward, my prediction is that you would recognize this very common phenomenon, which is a competition of cells. We know that one of the reasons change is difficult is that the things that we want to change, whether they're habits or addictions or patterns or new goals and new versions of ourselves that we're trying to create, the change is difficult because there really are two parts of ourselves or two sides of ourselves that want very different things. And almost any change that we aspire to, you can think of in terms of a competition of cells, that there's a part of you who doesn't want to make the change and wants to be in control of your choices. And there's a part of you who really knows that this change is in your best interest and wants to begin that process, even though it's difficult or uncomfortable. And I actually define willpower not in the way that many people define it, which would be the ability to force yourself to do what you don't really want to do. But I define willpower as the ability to make choices that are consistent with your long-term goals and values, even when this other part of you wants to choose something else. And so the strength that I'll be talking about today, this whole idea of building willpower, the neuroscience of willpower, what we're really talking about is how do you put in charge of your choices that part of you who really knows what matters most to you and is aligned with your highest values and your purpose and that version of yourself that you really want to bring to the world. That's what I mean by willpower. And I believe it's the key strengths that we need in order to make difficult change. Now, we actually know from neuroscience that you can see this competition of cells play out in the brain, that you can actually see different cells represented by different systems of the brain. What you're looking at here is a sort of simplified schematic of some of the earliest thinking in neuroscience about what these different selves are, that there's a self who is impulsive, and when you are the version of yourself who's really interested in immediate pleasure or immediate relief from pain or discomfort, that impulsive self, you are being dominated by systems of the brain that are more in the midbrain, these evolutionarily older sort of survival mechanisms that help you avoid pain and get immediate gratification. And that when you are the sort of the self of self-control, the sort of wiser self or higher self, thinking about your long-term goals and your most important values, that you have more strongly activated in the brain systems like the prefrontal cortex that are associated with more recently evolved survival mechanisms, the ability to delay gratification as a survival mechanism, the ability to get along with others and be part of a social community. But these are still survival strategies, but they require a little bit more self-control, a little bit more perspective taking. And again, you can see this actually play out in the brain when you ask someone to make a choice. For example, lots of neuroscience of willpower studies will ask someone who aspires to be healthier to make a choice between a very tempting food and a healthier food. And you can actually see in the brain these different systems become more or less activated, sort of battling it out. And if the person makes the healthier choice, you see that what happens is the prefrontal cortex became more engaged and it began to regulate these midbrain regions. If the person made the tempting choice, you actually see the prefrontal cortex sort of didn't generate enough force to regulate the impulsive cells. So you can sort of watch this competition of cells play out in the brain. You can probably feel it too yourself. You can feel those cells having a kind of a competition in your own thoughts and emotions. One thing that I find really interesting is you also can see this competition of cells play out in the nervous system. So, of course, your mind is not just in your brain and your skull. Your mind is in your whole body, and that includes your nervous system. And it seems as though when people are more aligned with their impulsive self, you see a nervous system pattern that looks more like a fight or flight or perhaps a freeze experience in the body, that you see one aspect of the autonomic nervous system be most strongly activated. Typically, it's that fight or flight, that sympathetic nervous system is more strongly activated. But sometimes, like for me, you know, I talked about my big willpower challenge, overcoming my fear of flying. And it's certainly the case that sometimes I experience fear as a kind of paralysis, which is the parasympathetic nervous system dominating and literally freezing you so you feel unable to even like take a step, say, onto a plane. We know that when people are aligned with their wiser self, the self of self-control, you actually see a balanced autonomic nervous system. So you see sympathetic and parasympathetic co-activation that seems to allow us to really balance the opposites of our competing selves and puts us in a physiological state that gives us energy to do what's important, but also slows us down a little bit so that we're not making these super impulsive choices to just feel good now or avoid feeling bad now. It's kind of interesting that you can see this competition of cells playing out in the brain and in the body. And I wanted to spend some time encouraging you to think about who your competing selves are. I can describe the competing cells in a general way. And I think hopefully you'll recognize them because no matter what the change is, whether you're trying to become healthier, whether you're trying to overcome an addiction, overcome a fear, pursue a new goal that's going to require a lot of persistence and effort, cultivate a virtue like kindness or integrity, whatever that change is, I think you'll probably recognize that you're going to come up against resistance from a particular type of self who finds the process of change intimidating or unwelcome. So let's talk first about the self who is often willing to invest in change. So this is the self who chooses what matters most. And what matters most to you when you really drop into a place of thinking deeply and connecting with your heart and your mind, not just what you really want now, if you were sort of shrinking your lens or your focus to in this moment, what would feel best or feel most comfortable. And I should say, when I think about willpower and change, I'm really interested in what you want for yourself, not what society wants for you or your spouse wants for you. You know, sometimes we get good advice, but really at the end of the day, I think it's most important to pursue what you have a sense of authentic alignment with. So it's not about your doctor telling you you need to change, or you know, you having some voice in your head from your parents who wanted you to be a certain way decades ago, and you still feel that impulse to please them. This is about you. So the self who is willing to make this change also is willing to balance long-term and present happiness. The self of self-control is not the self who wants you to be miserable now for some possible reward in the future. The self of self-control, or this wiser self, understands that it isn't always this black and white choice, that there's a way of pursuing change that can feel meaningful now, even if it's also a little bit difficult or uncomfortable. There's a part of yourself who can take joy even in difficult change. And the self of this process, this self is going to try to find a way to balance your current happiness and meaning and your long-term happiness and meaning. Is not only thinking about future well-being and willing to sacrifice all current happiness to invest in the future. The self of the self-control is willing to make time, does not feel the same kind of time urgency or scarcity that would lead us to say, oh, it's too much now. You know, I'll do this tomorrow. I'll do it next year. Is willing to make time for what matters most. And the self is also willing to tolerate discomfort, does not believe that life is supposed to be easy and your ideal life is one in which you're never uncomfortable. So that self is also then willing to exert effort, is willing to have experiences that are challenging, and is willing to sort of take care of yourself so that you have the energy that you need. The self of self-control really relies on the self of self-care. The self of self-control also pays a lot of attention to your choices, is paying attention to what you do, what you say, what you're feeling. There's an aspect of mindfulness that is embedded in the self. We also see it in the neuroscience. Systems of paying attention inward and outward are more activated when you are making wise choices. There is literally more of the brain is paying attention to what's happening inside and outside. There's more attention being paid, period. We also know that the self who can make a change has confidence that the goal is possible, believes in you in the way that a mentor might, can take that big perspective that says, no matter what you've done in the past, I believe that growth and change is possible. The self of self-control also has a bigger than self mindset. We know that the sort of the impulsive self often has a very constricted point of view that really is only about me. It's egocentric, sort of wants what I want and wants it now, but also doesn't even understand the resources that are available. And the self of self-control, this wiser self, has a bigger than self perspective that both allows you to understand whatever you're dealing with is sort of part of humanity, that you're not alone in it, and also is willing to look for resources that are bigger than yourself, whether it's relying on friends and family, whether it's finding other people who share your struggle, whether it's relying on faith or philosophy, something bigger than you, and can incorporate that into the process of change. It's not just this me, 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 I need to do it, or I want what I want when I want it, egocentricity. And then finally, the self of self-control has insight into this very process we're talking about. The person who can pay attention to the competition of cells is already the version of you, and it's the systems of the brain that are going to make better choices, which is one of the reasons I'm spending so much time trying to get you to appreciate this competition of selves. Because when you can see these different parts of yourself interacting and struggling, if you can actually see it play out, that mindful curiosity about it, like, wow, I actually feel the struggle right now. And I can sense myself moving toward the self, the impulsive self. And I need to maybe bring in that self of the wiser self. When you're watching that happen, you already are bringing forward the self of the wiser self. Okay, so that's one self. Who is that self competing with? It's competing with the impulsive self who wants pleasure and wants to avoid discomfort. And that is priority number one. It's basic human impulse. It's a basic impulse of anything that's alive. And really wants to focus on this immediate gratification or relief. The time scale that the self is thinking about is short and is willing to suffer in the future if I can avoid the pain now. This impulsive self also has no time. Not only has no time perspective, but also often feels like there's no time. We know that time scarcity, the sense that there's too much to do and not enough time to do it in, or the sense that everything needs to change now. Like, I can't tolerate how things are. It needs to change now. Any sort of time urgency or time pressure can really push us to actually be a sort of a worse version of ourselves. It's one of the reasons why mindfulness, by the way, is so supportive of change. You may have had this experience already, that mindfulness actually seems to slow down time, that it creates a physical sense of time abundance that actually can allow you to shift into the self who has a bigger perspective. So the impulsive self also often thinks that change is too hard. It's too hard, and I want what's easier. It wants to go to the default. It just, when it thinks about the process of change, it seems like too much. And the self prefers to run on what's automatic. It prefers what's automatic. The impulsive self is kind of conservative. It thinks that if something is easier, it's easier to think, it's easier to do, that it's somehow better. It values what is easier and what is by default. This impulsive self often lacks confidence in your ability to change. Or it might believe that change is hard now, but it's going to be easier in the future. So you'll start to, if the impulsive self is in charge, you might be thinking things like, I just can't quit today, or I can't start today. But I really believe, like, next month, things are going to be calmer in my life. I'll have a different attitude. It'll be easier then. So the impulsive self just does not think now is the day, and really will produce a lot of self-doubt. And at the same time, sort of this big paradox, I mentioned that the wiser self has a bigger than self perspective, and the impulsive self is so self-focused, and it's not just self-focused, it's self-focused on the impulsive self. It doesn't even believe that your wiser self exists. It doesn't know who you are. It believes that who you really are is the one who can't tolerate discomfort, who needs gratification immediately. The impulsive self has no idea who you are. I think that's such an interesting aspect to that particular self. When you find yourself experiencing high levels of self-doubt, you'll know that the impulsive self is in charge. Okay, so that's the competition of selves. And hopefully, I'd ask you to think about change that you want to make in your life. Hopefully, you're already recognizing these two parts of yourself. And we are never going to get rid of this impulsive self, the one who finds change difficult. It is so embedded in human nature. It is in our DNA. It's built into our brains. And I think the challenge, as I said, of willpower, of change, is finding a way to make choices consistent with your highest values and goals, even knowing that this competition is ongoing and there's always going to be a part of you who is going to want to put the change off or who finds the change too difficult. So our agenda today, I'm going to share with you three relatively new studies. Like, some of them are really recently published. Hopefully they'll be new to you, even if you follow the science. And talk with you about the strategies that they reveal that will help you put the wiser self in charge of your decisions. So we are going to look at empathy and self-compassion as a catalyst for change and a support for putting your wiser self in charge. We're going to look at the process of clarifying your values and affirming them. and the process of accepting inner experiences that are really difficult, thoughts, emotions, cravings, pain, and choosing commitments that are consistent with your goals and your values. So that's our agenda for today. And I want to start with a little bit of neuroscience and introduce you to an area of the brain that does not get the kind of attention. You know, there's some areas of the brain I think we've all heard about, like the amygdala, and the temporal parietal junction does not get a lot of press. This is a really interesting area of your brain. This is an area of your brain that is where the temporal lobe meets the parietal lobe. You can obviously see it here spinning around. You've got a right one and a left one. And this area of the brain seems to be really important for social cognition and empathy. So when you are trying to understand what someone else is thinking and feeling, when you're trying to put yourself in someone else's shoes, that kind of perspective taking, this region is critical for it. If you have damage to this region of the brain, you have a very difficult time with something called theory of mind, that is having a theory about what other people are thinking and feeling. You actually can only imagine from an egocentric point of view. You really only know what you are thinking and feeling in this moment when this part of the brain is damaged. So we know that this part of the brain, it's super important for empathy and for social cognition. And I want to tell you about a study that was done at the University of Zurich that looks at what happens to self-control and decision-making when you impair this region of the brain. So this study actually uses a really interesting, pretty recent technology called transcranial magnetic stimulation. And you can see here an illustration of what this technique is, TMS. It takes a magnetic coil, and you don't actually have like do brain surgery here. You can just put it close to the scalp. And that magnetic coil can emit pulses that either disrupt and deactivate a certain region of the brain, or there's another version that can actually increase activation in a certain region of the brain. So scientists actually have tools that are like turning on and off different parts of your brain, which is fascinating. And in this particular study, they decided they wanted to manipulate this region of the brain that is so critical for empathy and thinking about other people. And so in this study, they asked people to make decisions that reflect what they consider to be self-control. So one of the types of decisions they were asked to make is to decide between a smaller reward now, like I'm going to give you $50 when you leave today, or if you will wait 3 months, I'm going to mail you a check for $150. And which one would you prefer? This is a classic test of self-control or delay of gratification. Most people prefer more money than less money. Most people can reasonably understand that it would be very hard to turn $50 into $150 in 3 months through any kind of investment. It's not going to like magically triple in value. So the logical, reasonable thing to do is to choose the bigger reward. Like that actually is worth more to me. I should make that choice. But many people, they discount future rewards because the strength of the desire for immediate gratification. And this is considered to be an index of self-control. Basically, how much do I need to increase that future reward to get you to value it more than money in your hand today? And what the researchers did is they would give people a series of these financial choices and then disrupt this region of the brain that's so critical for empathy and for social cognition, for thinking about other people. And what they found is that if you disrupt this area of the brain, people make less wise choices. They basically don't want the future reward. The future reward has to be worth so much more for them to choose it that this impairing this region of the brain makes people just want immediate gratification. And they found that the same thing would happen when people were asked to make pro-social decisions. So in this case, they were asked to think about someone they know who they don't know very well and told that they're given, say, $150. And there are two choices here. We could give it all to you, or we could give some to this other person. What choice would you like to make? And they were considering the pro-social choice, the self-control, because most people aspire to be generous. If they think about it from a very big perspective, they might think, well, it might be nice to give someone else a little surprise bonus too, because I know how good it felt for me when I found out I was getting money in the study and didn't have to do anything to earn it. What they found is that when this area of the brain was impaired, people were not making pro-social choices. So people are much more selfish. Now, I'm not saying that the right thing to do is to give other people money all the time. There could be reasons to choose it for yourself. But they did these two different studies to really link together this idea that this area of the brain is really important for making empathic choices, sort of compassionate pro-social choices where you're having empathy for someone else, and also having empathy for your future self. And this is an idea that I found so helpful for thinking about how do we make difficult choices, that one of the things that gets in the way of making a change is lacking empathy for your future self. By the way, the picture that you're looking at now, this comes from a study that looked at people's willingness to invest in their retirement accounts based on how connected they felt to their retirement age self. And one of the studies actually had people meet a 3D avatar of their retirement age self. So I actually got to make a photograph of my, it was supposed to be 92 in this picture. I think I look amazing for 92. So I'm not sure how accurate that picture is. I doubt my hair will look like that when I'm 92, if I should be so lucky to live that long. But so that's who that is, that you're looking at my future self, in theory. And what researchers have found is that when most people think about their future self, the future self often feels like a stranger. So you might look at these interlocking circles that you see in front of you, and researchers have asked people, which set of circles best describes the way you feel about the overlap between who you are now and who you're going to be in the future, say 10 years from now? Do you think that future self is going to be pretty much who you are now? Sure, some things are going to change about your life and about who you are, but sort of the core of who you are, that's not going to change. So you would see that represented by the most overlapping circles on the bottom right. And you could go all the way down the continuum to 10 years from now, I don't know who that is. I don't expect it to be who I am now. I can't even imagine or believe that I'm going to be 10 years older at some point. That's complete disconnection, sort of lack of empathy and lack of continuity with your future self. You can sort of think about where you would be on this scale. I know when I first saw the scale, you know, I felt very strongly on the sort of the continuity side, the overlapping circles. And I remember even thinking, who on earth would pick the circles where there's no overlap? Like, does anyone do that? So I showed it to my husband and I asked him, and he was like, oh, that's me. And he's pointing to the far left, no overlap. I'm like, oh, that explains a lot of things, I think, about why we disagree on certain things. So wherever you are, it might be useful to know that research says, people who have the more overlapping circles are much more likely to invest in their future self in every way. So they're more likely to save for retirement, but they also are more likely to eat healthy food. They're more likely to exercise. They're more likely also to make difficult ethical choices, ones that require giving up the possibility for immediate gains in favor of really saying it's more important for me to stick to values like honesty and integrity. And so that's sort of an interesting parallel. And some researchers have looked at what happens if you can actually push people down this continuum so that they have more empathy for their future selves. And there are many ways that you can try to have more empathy for your future self, but literally just imagining your future self, imagining yourself in the future and thinking about what will life be like and what will I want and what will I care about. It actually has been shown to increase a sense of care and duty and empathy for your future self in a way that changes the choices that people make. So they are more likely to make these choices that might be a little uncomfortable now or a little bit of sacrifice or takes a little bit of courage in the present moment. But you know your future self is going to benefit if you're willing to invest in yourself in this way. So this is this idea that, and again, sort of the reason I'm talking about this, if you've sort of lost the thread here, that study that I showed you, the neuroscience study, that was, I think, really demonstrating the key role that empathy plays in self-control. It's just that the empathy you're having is for your future self. And if you disrupt the ability to have empathy for someone other than your immediate self, you actually lose the ability to make good choices for your future self. Okay, so I want to talk now about somebody else you need to have some empathy for, and that would be your struggling self. So in addition to needing to have empathy for your future self, it seems to be really important to have empathy for the self who is getting in the way of change, the self who is experiencing cravings or anxiety or lacks energy, who maybe is depressed and can't find motivation, can barely get out of bed. Whoever the self is who's struggling to make a change, we also need to have empathy and compassion for that part of ourselves. And although that neuroscience study I showed you didn't look at it, my prediction is when you're interrupting empathy for your future self, you're also interrupting empathy for your struggling self. We know that self-compassion requires actually taking a perspective in which you can be in relationship to the impulsive self or the scared self or the addicted self or the depressed self, that you actually need to have a kind of a mindful witnessing of the part of you who's struggling. And it looks very much like the process of having empathy or compassion for someone else. You need to be able to step back a little bit, take a bigger perspective, and really see the pain or the difficulty or the struggle that you're in, but not be completely drowning in it. That, the impulsive self can only see that. And because it can only see that, there's no breathing room to even have compassion for yourself for being in it. So this is another empathy or compassion that we need to cultivate for the process of change. And I wanted to try a thought experiment with you to give you a practice that you could try. I'll describe it now. You could do a super short version of it now as I describe it. But I want to encourage you to think about, maybe take a note if this appeals to you. And this is a great experiment to do in a longer form, to maybe take 10 minutes to do this for yourself. I use this in a lot of my classes and workshops. And this is one of the exercises I get the most positive feedback from people who take the time to really spend a few minutes with it. And this is the practice of connecting to your future self. So you're going to try to connect to and imagine your future self, and you're going to become your future self in order to offer compassion to your present struggling self. So this is what the exercise is. You're going to imagine yourself in the future as a version of yourself who has resolved whatever the change is that you're trying to make. And you can pick any time scale you want. You could pick 10 years in the future, 20 years in the future, 1 year in the future. The time scale you pick, it's not like you're deciding it's going to take that long. If you decide to pick yourself 20 years in the future, you're not saying it's going to take 20 years to make this change. You're just saying, I feel like that's a future self who's really going to have perspective on what I'm going through now. So sometimes picking a more future self can be even more helpful. So you're going to imagine that you're that self, that wiser self, who really can look back and see everything that you've done to resolve this struggle and to make a positive change in your life. And you're going to imagine sort of how grateful you might be to yourself and the point of view that you would have on what's difficult right now that's making that change hard to fully commit to. And you're going to write a letter to yourself, or you're going to do a visualization where you imagine talking to your present self. And you're going to offer a message of compassion, a message of self-compassion. So your future self is going to say to your present self, I understand what you're going through right now and why it's difficult. And your future self will say to yourself, I also know that what you really want is X, Y, and Z. What you really care about is this. And really articulate for yourself what you aspire to and why it matters to you. Your future self will remind you that change is difficult. And if it were easy, it would already be done. This is so human to struggle, whatever you're dealing with. You're not the only one. And many people have made this type of change, and you're someone who can do it. You're going to give yourself a message of encouragement, whatever you think your present self needs to hear. Maybe it's a growth mindset of really encouraging yourself to believe that change is possible. Maybe it's some specific advice. Like, your future self knows what you had to do. It's amazing. If you connect to your future self might actually have some ideas about what you had to do to get to this place where this change was made. and maybe we'll give you some very actionable advice. Who knows? You have to check in with this future self. So whatever it is that you need to hear, that message of encouragement or support or wisdom, and you can do it in a meditation where you can write it in a letter and actually read it back to yourself. And if I were to do this for myself with this change that I had talked about, the fear of flying, you know, I might have written a letter, "Dear Kelly, I know that you feel trapped in a cycle of fear and you are desperately trying to avoid all of these experiences you don't want to have, the nightmares of flying and the experience of flying and feeling out of control and these traumatic memories that keep coming up. You're doing everything you can to protect yourself from that and it's not working. And your life is controlled by that fear. And I want to let you know that actually I know that this change is possible." And then, you know, so I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but that's sort of the way that I mean it. And to give yourself this advice from the point of view of someone who believes the change is possible, knows that you're capable of it, and yet still understands what this struggle is. So this is such a great exercise because you are going to be cultivating both types of empathy. The empathy you have for your future self, who knows that you are the recipient of whatever change you make today or choices you make today. But you also will be practicing self-compassion and empathy for that self who's struggling. Okay, so we're going to move on to another part of the brain now. The ventromedial prefrontal cortex. Again, you're looking at a couple of different images of it. And this part of the brain that's sort of behind your eyes and underneath the frontal lobe, so the very bottom of it, this is a part of the brain that I call the hub of want power in your brain. And want power is the ability to know what your big goals and values are. So we know that, like, if you aspire to health and you see a cookie, the most strongly activated part of your brain is deeper in the midbrain. It's the, you know, the deep part of the reward system that's like, yum, desire. That's not want power. Want power, this more sort of frontal region of the brain, that's a part of the brain that's like, do I want something that tastes good now and then I'm going to regret? Or do I want to make choices where when I wake up in the morning, I'm going to be full of energy, I'm going to feel good, I'm going to have the energy and the wellness to engage with life? Is that what I really want? Yes, that's what I really want. That's want power. It's represented in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. Again, neuroscience that has looked at asking people to make choices that are consistent with their long-term or their short-term interests. People who make the choices consistent with their biggest values and goals, you see this part of the brain become more strongly activated, and the degree of activation is correlated with sort of the strength of that value, say the value for health or the value for freedom or sort of whatever the big value is. So I love this part of the brain. And I'm going to tell you about a study that looks at how you can activate it to support the process of change. So this was a study that was done at the University of California in Los Angeles. And they recruited a bunch of adults from the community, sort of all ages, who were sedentary. They were not exercising. And they recruited them into a study that was designed to try to motivate them to exercise more. And if I'm remembering this right, I believe they did not tell people in the study that it was an exercise study because they really wanted people who like would have some serious conflict with this. They didn't want people who were like, ooh, exercise study, I'm signing up for that. So there are people who did not exercise and they go to the study and they find out, oh, this is a study in which I'm going to be encouraged to exercise. So the intervention that everyone got in this study was an intervention designed to motivate movement. And so they were given a certain amount of messages that were meant to inspire and also a little bit threaten people, with messages like a sedentary lifestyle increases your risk of everything you don't want, diabetes, depression, cancer, you name it. Messages like the more you sit, the more damage you do to your body. Sitting is toxic. But also some positive messages like we know being active can help you deal with stress and it's good for your health. Okay, now, I know you probably already know all this, so did probably everyone who was in the study. But then they're also going to be given tips that choices they can make every day that are consistent with the positive outcomes that people want, like health and dealing well with stress. So they get tips like choose the last row of the parking lot whenever you go grocery shopping or wherever you're running errands so that you have to walk a little bit further. You know, take the stairs instead of taking the elevator. They're given little daily tips, choice points, so that they can enact this change in a way that, that really fits into their life. Okay, so that's the movement intervention. But some of them also got a values intervention. So let me tell you about this part of the intervention. In this case, people were asked to think about what is most important to them. What's most important to you? By the way, you can do this right now. We could like stage our own little intervention. Just right now, thinking about what's most important to you and how it gives you purpose in life. And so in this particular study, a lot of people would say things like family or faith or my work. And I don't know what it would be for you, but what's really important in your life that gives you meaning or gives you joy or gives you satisfaction. And then they were asked to think sort of concretely about this. You know, think of a way that this value is important in your life and how you express it in your life. And maybe you're doing that now. Okay, so this study was kind of complicated. Not only were people getting this sort of intervention in the laboratory, but while they were receiving these messages, and while some of them were thinking about what was most important to them in their lives, they also were in a brain imaging machine so that researchers could see what areas of the brain were being activated. So I'll tell you a little bit more about what they saw in a moment. So that's happening. The researchers are looking at what's happening in the brain as they're receiving these messages. The second part of the study is everyone is signing up to receive text messages that will remind them of what they thought about in the laboratory. So if you're in the study, you agree to get text messages that will remind you to exercise. And then the people who also thought about their most important values, they are also going to get text messages that remind them of their most important values. So if you're in this value condition, you might get a text message while you're running errands. And it says, think about a way that your family is really important to you, if you identified your family as your most important value. And then you're also going to get a text message that says, by the way, remember, one way that you can be active is to park at the end of the parking lot so that you have to walk further. Okay, so you're not just getting text messages about exercise, but you're getting reminded of what matters most to you. Okay, so sort of complicated study. So let me tell you what they found. First of all, they were looking at what happened in the brains of people while they were getting messages about exercise. And what they found is that for the participants who were first primed to think about what matters most to them, they did this values affirmation before they got the messages about why exercise matters and what they can do to be more active. If they thought about their values beforehand, when they got that health information, that information about being active, even the information that was a little bit threatening, they showed stronger activation of the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, that the part of the brain that was listening to this information about why movement is important and what you can do to make that change, the part of the brain that was listening was the want power part of the brain. It was actually beginning to incorporate this new information or information they already knew into the part of the brain that thinks about what matters most. And that's really interesting, right? Because usually what we see is when people get health messages that are kind of threatening, you actually see this part of the brain shut down. It's like, I don't want to hear this. I don't want to think about my death. I don't want to think about having to change. So thinking about their values first made the brain more receptive. It brought in this self who takes a big perspective and believes that change is possible and is beginning to think about how maybe this behavior change, being healthier, having more energy, living longer, dealing well with stress, maybe that's linked to what I really care about, like my family or my work. Okay, so that's sort of the neuroscience finding. Then they also looked at actual behavior. They gave everyone in the study accelerometers that they were using to track movement in everyday life. And they found two really interesting things. One is that the people who got the values affirmation part of the intervention, they became significantly more active and less sedentary compared to people who only got the messages about exercising more. So for example, they went from being sedentary, inactive, sitting down from 51% of the day to only 38% of the day. That is a huge decrease in sedentary time. That's clinically significant. They also increased their activity. One way to think about it is they were active for over 2 hours a day more. That's crazy, 2 hours a day being more physically active. That's a lot of walks they're taking or going to the gym or, you know, gardening, whatever the activity was. And again, this is not self-report. This is as measured by an accelerometer that they were wearing. So the last finding that I want to share with you is they actually found that the degree of increase in activity was correlated to what they saw in the brain when people were receiving these messages of change. So the more that the ventromedial prefrontal cortex was active when they were getting this information, the bigger change they made over the following month. I should have said, you can see this on the graph, but over the following month. So I love this study because I think this is so practical that what this is telling us is that if you want to make a change, it is really important to clarify your values and regularly affirm them. This is the strategy. And the first step is actually to just ask yourself what matters most in your life. The self who can make change, that self needs to know what its values are and what its biggest goals and aspirations are. And if you don't make the time in your everyday life to reflect on that, you are crippling the self of change and the self of self-control. I have to say, I don't even really like that word self-control, even though it's often what you see in the scientific literature. But I like this phrase, the wiser self. So if you want that wiser self to be in charge of your choices, you need to help it by regularly checking in with what matters most to you, what your values and your deepest goals are. So I wanted to give you another thought experiment. This is something that you could do right now, but it's better if you take a few minutes to do it. And I call it the 3-why exercise. So I should say one of the things you can do is the exercise I already showed you. Like, forget the change. Just figure out what matters to you. And that in and of itself will support any change that is actually beneficial and important to you. Now, if you're trying to make a change because somebody else wants you to or out of a place of shame, values affirmation is not going to help you. But I think that's just fine because you don't want to invest your energy and attention in something that's rooted in shame or social control. So one thing that you might find is if you're trying to make the wrong change in your life and you spend a lot of time affirming your values, you may find it's actually harder to make that change. And you may find that you have some goals that are not what you thought they were, which I love when that happens. Okay, so that's one exercise. But this other exercise, the why times 3, think about this change that you want to make in your life, the goal you're working toward, and to ask yourself why you want to make that change 3 times. And you can do this exercise multiple times. Sometimes things come up, but I'll give you my example just so you see what this exercise looks like. So if I were to ask my scared of flying self, why do you want to overcome this fear? Well, my first answer might be practical reasons. I want to be able to see my family more regularly. Like, you know, I not just make them travel to see me. So I want to see my family more regularly. That's a why. Maybe another practical why. I want to be able to go to conferences that I'm invited to or conferences that I want to attend to learn from. I want to be able to have those experiences. That's practical. And then I ask it again, and maybe what comes up is something a little bit deeper. Like, I'm really tired of being controlled by this. There's a kind of suffering where I feel like my life is controlled by this fear, and I don't like that. And that starts to come up. So that in itself is interesting, and I'm starting to get a sense of what my values are and what a core motivation is. You can do the exercise again and pick maybe any one of them and say, why do you want that? So let's say I chose the family one and ask it again. Why do you want to see your family? And then I might say, like, because that's how I know who I am. That's the story of my life. I want to be able to deepen certain relationships. And so another sort of stronger value and why comes forward if I drill down on that why. Or maybe I choose the thing that really is standing out is this not wanting to be controlled by fear. And I could ask myself, why do you not want to be controlled by fear? And maybe what comes forward is, I want to feel free. Or maybe what comes forward is, ask it again. Because all of my role models are brave. When I think about who I admire, they're brave. And as long as I'm not being brave, I have a sense of myself not being who I want to be. I've asked that question 3 times. So even though I said it's, you ask it 3 times, but with each answer that comes up, maybe you drill down a little bit further and ask it again. It's a great exercise for finding the true want power behind a change. So I'll encourage you to take some time to do that for yourself with whatever change you want to make. Okay, I'm going to talk about one last system of the brain. And this is the craving network of the brain. By the way, the image that you're looking at here, it comes from a study that was done through researchers at Yale and the Pittsburgh Brain Imaging Research Center. And this was a study that was looking at people who wanted to quit smoking. And we know that smoking is one of the strongest biological, psychological, and social addictions. So as a model for change, you know, quitting smoking is one of the most difficult changes that a human being can make. So, you know, any study that looks at that process, I think, is sort of proof. It's proof of concept for whatever they are. It reveals about the process of change. So this was a study. People wanted to quit smoking. And part of what the researchers were doing was looking at what happens in the brain when people who want to quit smoking are tempted with cigarettes and experience a desire to smoke that comes into conflict with their desire to quit. And the image that you're looking at here is showing you the main systems of the brain or regions of the brain that are co-activated during a craving, not just for a cigarette, but also for a cigarette. So let me walk you through these regions of the brain. By the way, I know not all of you are used to looking at pictures from brain imaging studies. What you're looking at on the left side is you're looking at slices of the brain that you can see where they were sliced from by looking at that picture on the right. So those red lines are showing you, like if you were to take a saw to someone's brain and saw off chunks of the brain, you're looking at where those slices are made from right to left. So that picture you're looking at on the right is showing four slices of the brain moving inward from the right side of the brain all the way past the midline to the left side of the brain. And that particular image you're looking at front to back. Okay, so that's sort of what's happening there. Trying to show you what you're looking at on the left. And the images on the left are moving in from the right side of the brain, moving in towards the middle of the brain. If that didn't make sense, don't worry about it. But just to sort of help you, since this is a neuroscience summit, help you understand when you look at pictures of the brain what you're looking at. Okay, so we're looking at activation of regions of the brain, starting with the insula, which is a part of the brain that is associated with embodied emotions and particularly uncomfortable emotions. It's also important for social emotions like compassion, but the insula has been very strongly linked to pain, to anxiety, to discomfort, to disgust. It's if you think about what it feels like in your body when you're like, ugh. The insula is very strongly implicated in that feeling, like there's something wrong and it's in my body. And when it comes to a craving, we know that one of the strongest aspects of a craving is not just desire, but it's a feeling of deep discomfort and almost pain. Like, I am not comfortable right now. And the only thing that will make this discomfort go away is if I give into whatever activated the craving. So the insula, as part of the craving network, is producing profound discomfort. And if you've ever had a craving, you know that this is actually what makes you give in. It's not just the desire you're feeling. It's that you are feeling your skin crawling, or you are feeling pressure and urgency or anxiety that makes you want to give in. So the next part of the brain that you're looking at involved in a craving is the premotor cortex. And that's the part of the brain that plans your physical movement. And when it comes to a craving, what happens is when you start to experience a craving, your brain is already trying to prime you to give in. And it's actually creating a movement program that says, okay, what do I need to give in? My right hand needs to reach into my pocket for the cigarettes and pull them out and, you know, get my lighter. And you can actually see highly specific activation. So for example, if a smoker is right-handed and they're experiencing a craving for a cigarette, you particularly see activation in the area of the motor cortex that controls the right hand. It's very interesting. Okay, and the last part of the craving network is the reward system. It's represented here by the ventral striatum. But this is the part of your brain that tells you something will feel good and makes you want to approach it. So it's for any craving. You're going to see this activation that says, you know, eat me, buy me, drink me, touch me, consume me, go after me, chase me. This is the part of the brain that gives you that promise of reward. So this is what a craving looks like in the brain. And you can understand when you think about all of these systems being co-activated, hopefully it helps you understand your own cravings a little bit better. And you can understand why it's so difficult to overcome a craving, because you are feeling incredibly uncomfortable and your brain is telling you that the only way to relieve it and feel good is to consume whatever the object of your craving is. And your brain is figuring out how to make you do it so that your body is ready to pull out your credit card or pull out your cigarette or reach for the fork or whatever the behavior is, the impulse is. Okay, so now you know what a craving is in your brain. So this particular study, there, remember, it's of people who want to quit smoking. They put people in a brain imaging scanner and they show them pictures of cigarettes and then ask them about their cravings and their distress. So they're going to ask them, how much do you want to smoke right now? And how distressed are you about the fact that you can't smoke? And, you know, by the way, you cannot smoke in a brain imaging scanner. No, no, no. So nobody is smoking. So how much you want it and how distressed are you? And the participants have actually been taught how to mindfully accept their cravings and their distress. So they're given a little mindfulness instruction that says, you know, by the way, one way to deal with wanting to smoke is to notice your cravings, to notice that you want to smoke, to notice any distress you feel around this. And you can just mindfully observe this inner experience you're having. You don't have to push it away. You don't have to change it. You don't have to suppress it. You can just mindfully attend to it. And what they found is that when the smokers were instructed to mindfully attend to their own cravings and distress, it actually lowered their cravings and distress. So it was a paradox of acceptance. The more they accepted it, the less intense the cravings and the distress, and the less activated certain regions of the craving network became, particularly the ventral striatum, that part of the brain that says, it's going to feel good, you need to do this. And it also disrupted the connectivity of these regions of the brain. So one of the reasons a craving is so powerful is it's not just that these parts of the brain are activated, but they're talking to each other and they're activated together. It's like a super strong link. And mindfulness started to cut some of these links so that even if you're still experiencing discomfort, there's not a strong connection between that discomfort and the part of your brain that is planning your movement and making your choices. So mindfulness is reducing activation of the craving network, and it's screwing it up. It's making it less strong. It is weakening the control that this network has over your choices. So I think that that's fascinating. And this is the next strategy, the last strategy I wanted to share with you, acceptance and commitment. That too often when we're trying to make a change, we are controlled by inner experiences, whether they're emotions, whether they're thoughts and beliefs, whether it's physical pain, whether it's a craving, and we allow ourselves to be basically controlled, like we're a puppet by these inner experiences that tell us what we need to do in order to relieve an emotion or relieve our pain or relieve our cravings. And what's so interesting about accepting those inner experiences while remembering what you really are committed to is that it's like cutting the strings. And you can actually see it in the brain by this sort of disruption of the network, the systems of the brain that push you towards habitual behavior or addictions or old patterns. That acceptance is literally cutting those strings that control you. And you might still have the fear, or you might still have that intrusive memory. You might still have self-doubt, but those inner experiences are no longer in control of your choices, and you are free to stick with your commitments and your goals. Now, I wanted to tell you about one last study because, you know, there's a lot of research on this, and I wanted to show how it can apply not just to won't power, the ability to not do something, but it can also strengthen your ability to persist at doing something that is difficult or uncomfortable. So this was a study done at the National University of Ireland that was a study of pain and electric shocks. And in this particular study, people came in and they were told it was a study of trying to understand pain to help people who had chronic pain. And everyone in this study endorsed that goal. They wanted to help the researchers understand pain, and they wanted to help people who experience chronic pain. So the first part of the study is sort of testing their pain tolerance. And they're given a series of increasingly painful electric shocks. And they're told that they can quit at any point in time that it becomes too much. And they're also asked to pay attention to what the thoughts are that they have or the emotions that they have that make them want to stop. So for some people, it might be, this is too much, I can't handle it. For someone else, it might be, why am I doing this? This is crazy. I don't need to feel this pain. For someone else, it might be, I need to make this stop. It hurts too much. You know, whatever it is, to really notice that. So they know what made them stop, the thought, the belief, the feeling. And then they go through an intervention. Now, this intervention had a couple of different versions. Some people got an intervention that was called distraction. And in the distraction intervention, what they were actually told to do is when they're feeling this pain or they think that they can't go on anymore, to imagine that there's somewhere else that they'd rather be. Like imagine you're at the beach. I mean, you get to choose where you want to be. And distract yourself from these thoughts, distract yourself from the pain. And then maybe you can go further in the study and endure more. Now, other people got the acceptance and commitment intervention. And I want to tell you about this one. You can actually do it, but where you are right now, you could role play this if you want to. It's called I Cannot Walk. And what people were asked to do is to have a thought in their mind, I cannot walk. So they are going to say in their own mind, I cannot walk, I cannot walk. You could try doing that right now. I cannot walk, I cannot walk. And then they were asked to stand up and walk around the room while repeating this thought in their head. I cannot walk, I cannot walk. You could try it right now if you're free to walk. Just stand up, walk around a little bit. You can even say it out loud if you want, I cannot walk, or just think it. And they were introduced to this curious fact that you can have a thought in your head and do the opposite, that is possible. No matter how strongly you believe the thought, you could choose its alternative, its opposite. And they were asked to remember what their thought was that stopped them from continuing with the pain. So if my thought was, I can't handle this, it's too much. I was told, you know, so when you have that thought, I can't handle this, it's too much. I want you to remember that you walked around while you were saying, I cannot walk. And if you want to keep going, you could, even though you have the thought, this is too much, I have to stop. Doesn't mean you have to keep going, but if you wanted to, you could have that thought, this is too much, I have to stop. And you could remember that you actually had a goal to go further, to help us understand pain and support people who suffer from chronic pain, and decide to keep going anyway. But that's totally possible, even if you're feeling pain and you have a belief that you can't keep going. Okay? And then other people, by the way, got no help whatsoever. They were just left to their own mind and the pain. Okay, so what were the results? Well, first of all, we can look at how many shocks they endured. Remember, each shock is getting increasingly painful. So the researchers found that people who got no advice made it through an average of 2.5 shocks in the second round, and then they were out. People who were distracting themselves made it through almost twice as many, 4.7. But the people who got this acceptance training, they made it through 8.4 shocks. That is not just a statistical difference. That's a huge experiential difference. They persisted, they endured, and they did it because they committed to it. They wanted to do it. It wasn't, you know, they weren't being over-manipulated by the researchers. They were just invited to experiment with how far they wanted to go. And the fascinating thing, too, is that not only did the people who were practicing mindful acceptance of their thoughts and their pain, not only did they go further, they actually reported less intense pain. And this is so similar to the smoking study, that when you bring in this quality of mindful acceptance, you actually are transforming the inner experience that you're struggling with. So even as they endured more objective physical pain, the mindful acceptance was reducing their felt experience of pain in the same way that mindfully accepting cravings reduce the intensity of cravings and distress about not smoking. So this is the last exercise I want to offer for you, a thought experiment you can try now or try it later. And the thought experiment is, what is the inner experience that pops up when you have the opportunity to choose your goal or value or make a change? In the case of smoking, it would be a craving. In the case of that pain experiment, It was maybe a thought that I can't handle pain. And by the way, I, as someone who experiences chronic pain, that study is very resonant for me because I often have to make a choice about trying to avoid something because I don't want to be in pain versus deciding I can handle a certain level of pain because this experience is important to me and I want to commit to it. In the case of flying, I had to make a choice that I would mindfully accept experiences of feeling trapped. That was the inner experience. I felt trapped when I was booking a plane ticket. I felt trapped when I was at the airport. I definitely felt trapped when I was on the plane. And I'll tell you a really just funny example of how I practice dealing with this inner experience, because for a long time before I was flying, I had to learn how to deal with that inner experience before I could get on a plane. I had to like scale this. So I asked myself, where else do I feel trapped? And like, I need to run out of the room now. And it was indoor cycling classes, which I hated and had tried once or twice. And when I was on that bike in that stuffy room with the teacher yelling at me, I felt that was the closest to what I felt on an airplane. Trapped, let me out of here. When is this going to be over? I can't breathe. And so I practiced going to cycling classes and dealing with my own inner experiences. And then I used that strength that I built to take a much more difficult step. So that's also a thought experiment you might try. If the change you're trying to make is so overwhelming that you can't practice it today, to ask yourself, where else do I feel something that is similar? Where else do I have that thought? Where else does that inner experience show up? And can you just practice mindful acceptance of it when it shows up in a context that feels more approachable right now, if the full version of it just doesn't feel approachable? So I want to just conclude before we go to Q&A, what I've been talking about today and put it in a bigger context. So we've been talking about this competition of selves. It's built into our biology. And all of the strategies that I gave you today were about trying to shift the balance of selves to put the wiser self in charge. And we looked at it from a brain point of view, like how you can activate these regions of the brain associated with empathy and good choices and knowing what your values are, and also start to take some control away from this more impulsive self. But I also want to remind you that, you know, I gave you three strategies, but you can think about life as a series of things that are supporting either your impulsive self or your wiser self. And everything from the news that you listen to the people you surround yourself with, the books that you read, even the summit that you're participating in now, they are all pushing you either towards the wiser self or the impulsive self. And so I really encourage you to think about trying to construct a life that really supports your wiser self by finding people who share your goals, or finding role models, by thinking about what you consume, the information you consume, even the food that you consume can be pushing you towards a wiser self or a more destructive self based on how it influences your blood sugar levels and inflammation and things like that. So I gave you a few examples today, but I really invite you to think about this competition of selves and the things that you can do that are really about self-care and supporting the wiser self. So thank you for your attention. I think we are going to pull out of the presentation and just go to Q&A.
Kelly, thank you so much for that. Lots of questions coming in. I wanted to start off by asking about the system of competing selves. I'm looking at that kind of like being in the center, maybe as my ego self, and the competing selves kind of radiate out like spokes on a wheel, or like the hub, around a hub. I'm wondering, is this the correct way to envision this dynamic, or am I inviting in one of those selves or the wiser selves to kind of govern the other ones who are kind of at odds with me?
It's so interesting. So, you know, it's interesting that you use the word center in relationship to ego. With the first thing that it brought up for me is that in my Zen training, we were often encouraged to go to center, and that center was this wiser self, that, you know, the mentor, the observer, the witness, the compassionate witness, and that when you are at center, that's who you are. And that's, you know, those are the choices you make and the perspective you can take. So those are the first thought I had, is that I don't know if that would resonate with others too, because when we talk about being centered, I really think we're talking about the physiology and the psychology of this wiser self. But if you're thinking about it visually, this idea that there could be at the center, like ego, and it's tight and it's small, and that the wiser self has room for the ego and the impulsive self, and it actually is bigger than that. When you were describing your visual, that was the aspect of it that really lit me up, got me excited. Mm-hmm. I think this idea that the wiser self has room for every self. It's not, when you look at the brain, I think you don't get a sense of this. You know, when you just look at the brain, it can almost look like a switch that you flip back and forth. Mm-hmm. But I really think the better way to understand it experientially is more like what you're describing, that the wiser self is big and spacious. In the same way we talk about mindfulness as being a quality of attention that has room for everything in the present moment. It's a spacious container for life. That's mindfulness. That quality of attention also describes the wiser self. It is aware of and can attend to every aspect of the self and find a way to integrate it. And the self, that impulsive self, or you know, sometimes we think of it as ego, that it doesn't have room for like anything. It is so constricted.
Yeah, you know, because I even feel a sense of tightness or smallness, as you know, just to think that my ego self, this tiny portion of who I actually am, or of who one actually is, kind of running the show, not quite possible.
Yes. And when you talk about that constriction, you know, I also teach yoga, and my favorite yoga poses are movements that are expansive, like sun breaths, where the arms go out and out to flutter, the goddess gesture, big, expansive, wide stance, and warrior poses. And I'm sure it has something to do with embodying this wiser self, that when we go into that expansive movement, we're also helping to connect to that psychology.
Okay. I want to start in with some questions from our participants. And the first one comes from Rosalyn. She writes, "My fear of public speaking is debilitating. Can you share a technique to embrace that stress and use it as a tool? My physical response is simply embarrassing."
Yes. Well, this is something I thought a lot about as someone who has a lot of fear and had a fear of public speaking and ended up in a career of public speaking. There's a lot of science on this. And I'm going to give you a few messages that the science suggests are both true and really helpful for you to remember. And in some ways, the messages themselves really are the strategy. So one of the first things that is so helpful to know is that the most successful performers and public speakers have very high levels of pre-performance anxiety. People looked at this with athletes and with singers and with speakers, that the people who you would say are at the top of their game are not less anxious beforehand. And people find that very hard to believe, because we believe that when your heart is racing and your mouth goes dry and you're experiencing self-doubt, if you've only had the experience that debilitates you, you can't imagine that people who are at the top of their game are having those same thoughts and physical changes in their bodies, but they are. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. Beyonce recently did an interview where she talked about this. She talked about channeling that energy. So first of all, to know that you do not need to get rid of it. People often are hoping for the strategy where I'm going to say, do this, and the anxiety is gone. So I want you to abandon that hope, if that was present, and know that there actually is a way to channel it, and that anxiety is really better thought of as a sign that you care, and that your body and brain know that you care, and they are trying to get your attention, they're trying to give you energy, that's why your heart is pounding. Even if you experience it as debilitating, there are aspects to what's happening in your body and brain that could actually fuel your performance and give you courage. And research shows that if you choose to take that mindset, my heart is pounding, my skin, I'm sweating, there's a voice in my head that says you can't do this. But it's saying that because it wants you to do well. And it's like trying to raise the stakes or be like, it's saying you can't do this because it's like, maybe if I say that, I'll help her know how important this is and like help her find the best version of herself. if you understand that all of that, from the heart pounding to the self-doubt, is trying to push you to be your best self, and you embrace it, that it actually helps people do better. It transforms what's happening in the brain and body into a slightly different kind of stress response that can fuel courage and engagement and help you be your best self. And that it can happen even if there's some part of you that just is terrified. So those are that's what I would encourage you to do. And then the last thing I'll encourage you to do is, particularly when it comes to something like public speaking, we know that the most terrified self who's going to be debilitated by anxiety thinks it's only about you and is worried about humiliating yourself, being revealed as a fraud, doing a bad job. It's not thinking about the audience. And one of the best ways to find the version of you who's going to show up with courage, the courage version of stress, rather than just the debilitating version of anxiety, is to think about why you're doing this in the first place, that is beyond the ego. And I will tell you that before I give a talk or teach a class, I always still get anxious. And I think to myself, who is my ideal audience member right now? I try to imagine who is suffering the most that could be most helped by something I say. And I just connect with a part of me that's like, please let me say something that is of value to the person in this room who is dealing with the most right now. Let me be a vehicle for that. And that I believe that that mindset also helps us channel the anxiety in a positive way by doing this sort of shift of which self is managing the stress and the anxiety.
You know, this actually touches on what you've said in previous talks about befriending stress. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about that and how you turned your teaching around from seeing stress as an enemy to embracing it and using it to benefit whatever situation we found ourselves in.
Yeah, it's been an interesting process for me. Being trained as a psychologist and in medicine and health psychology, and also studying yoga and meditation and mindfulness, every field that I was training in for years and years, they all agreed about one thing, which is that we're going to make stress the enemy. And everything we do is going to be to reduce stress, to eliminate stress, to manage stress, to improve health, to improve happiness, to be mindful, to be your best self, whatever. Everyone was like, stress is the enemy. And what we're doing is in service of getting rid of stress or reducing the toxic effects of stress. And I bought into that, even though what I was learning from both the science and from the contemplative traditions is anything you resist becomes more toxic. Anything you turn into the enemy becomes the enemy. And that the only thing that can transform suffering is a quality of acceptance and mindfulness and compassion that allows you to deal with reality as it is, and often transform things that start out as toxic into something that has some positive potential or can be put in service of things that you care about. And I knew that from everything I was studying, you know, studying chronic pain, I knew it was true about pain. Studying behavior change, I knew it was true about cravings and habits and addictions. From studying emotion regulation, I knew it was true of emotions like anger and sadness. And yet, for some reason, I refused to apply that same wisdom and mindset towards stress. And at a certain point in time, research started coming out showing that how you think about stress can either make it more toxic or transform it into something that actually has a lot of positive effects. And as this evidence was coming out, I was forced to confront the fact that I had kept stress outside the circle of acceptance and mindfulness and compassion. And that in doing so, by running around, reinforcing this message that if your life is stressful, your life is toxic and it's killing you, and you'll never be happy and you'll never be your best self until you're not stressed, that I was amplifying the truly toxic effects of stress and completely cutting people off from the ability to transform stress into growth or connection with others or energy and courage. And I had to deal with, you know, a lot of resistance in myself, the sort of the motivated reasoning we all engage in when we are confronted with the fact that we might be wrong about something or we might be creating harm when we're trying to do good. But it's the science that started to convince me. And then spending, you know, the last 7 years or so, I've been talking about stress differently and seeing the difference that it makes for other people when they are given a fuller picture of the harms and the potential positive effects of stress in terms of giving us energy or helping us prioritize what matters or being a catalyst for growth or strengthening communities, to know that we have some capacities to let stress be a catalyst for things that we care about, that actually empowers people while protecting them against some of the things we associate with stress, whether we're talking about heart attacks or depression. So, you know, the direct experience has given me the courage to keep doing this, but it was difficult. And I'm sure there are people listening now who are on all sides of the spectrum. Like, there are probably people listening now, if this is the first time they've heard any sort of conversation about stress mindsets or not viewing stress as the enemy, I'm sure there are people who are like, what? That's crazy. This lady is crazy. And then there are probably others listening who've made a similar journey themselves. Probably many who had that journey before I was able to make it. Because I think when you really look at direct experience, it would lead you to include stress in this broad circle of acceptance and mindfulness and compassion.
Mm-hmm. Valerie writes, I'm living with chronic pain and want to know how I can start the difficult habit of therapeutic exercise when pain levels are debilitating. How can I focus on the benefits of my future self when my current experience is so overwhelming?
Yeah, I think there, so this is something, again, I have some direct experience with. I'm going to throw out a couple of ideas and maybe one will sort of land as something that feels like something you can work with. The first is coming to a true sense that if you endure the exercise that is painful, it will help you. I've actually worked with a lot of people who don't really believe it. They've been told that it will, but if you don't really believe it, it completely changes your experience of going through it. So at a very first stage, I would say, if you have ambivalence, you doubt that this could lead to change, to investigate that and investigate it honestly. I'm not saying only like convince yourself it will, but is there an investigation process that will give you the kind of hope you need that gives you the ability to tolerate the discomfort of going through it? And where you would find that hope would be maybe talking to people who've been through it if you haven't already, looking for stories that inspire you, learning a little bit more about the science, looking for some of the evidence. I don't know what would give you that sense of hope, but if you aren't already committed to the belief that this will give you something you value, whether it's movement, function, reducing the pain, then investigate that. Because you need that hope and also if it weren't, then you wouldn't want to engage in it, right? I mean, you need the hope and you also need the belief that this truly is something that will support my future self. So starting there and then beginning to practice questions of self-care, like what would make this experience not necessarily not painful, but what would improve the experience of it? What can I bring to it that adds something positive to the discomfort? Is it who you do it with? Is it music that you could do it with that inspires you? Is there a particular type of music that reminds you of the values that are behind your desire to make this change? Is it that you are going to bracket the experience with things that are really meaningful to you before you do it and after you do it? Not like rewards to bribe yourself, but you're just going to put this exercise into a context that involves things you already love. So that would be something, and really, you know, find out what the version of it is that is sustainable now, the first step of it, and whoever's leading you through these exercises to get them on board with that too. So you're practicing hope, you're practicing self-compassion and self-care, and then you just begin to explore that last process we talked about the inner experiences that tell you to stop, and you notice what tells you to stop. You notice what the discomfort feels like, and you begin to practice mindfully accepting it, knowing that you care about yourself enough that you are choosing this autonomously and you always have freedom to stop. I think one of the things that makes the pain more difficult in change is if you don't trust yourself to stop when you need to stop. just like you don't trust yourself to start when you need to start. And there's some aspect of self-trust that says, I'm going to choose to endure this discomfort, but I'm not a masochist. And I care about myself enough to know what's possible in this moment. And I'm going to challenge myself and also care for myself and start practicing having that kind of self-trust that will let you experiment with engaging with different levels of intensity as you go through this process. So hopefully something that you heard in there feels like a starting point. And the other thing you can do is think about other people who are on this journey with you. When you're doing the exercises, even if you're doing them by yourself, to imagine the countless other people on the planet right now who are going through some type of rehab or some type of training or even just doing something that is really hard to do, but they are choosing to do it anyway. You could think about refugees getting on a boat. And there are a lot of people who are doing things that are scary and painful and difficult, and they're doing it because they believe it's in their best interest or the best interest of those they care about. So that might also be something to bring to the experience.
Kelly, when you were talking about the craving network and disrupting that cycle, I wonder if you could speak to how one could support the transition from dismantling that old cycle and either letting it go altogether or replacing it with a new positive habit that's aligned to one's goals.
Yeah, this is a tricky one. So I would say that there is a larger gap between the neuroscience and public understanding for this than for a lot of other things we've talked about. So when you look at the neuroscience of cravings, addictions, and habits, there really is not evidence that you are going to eliminate an old pattern and replace it with something equally strong and new, as much as people hope that they will. And I hate to end on like a note that is somewhat discouraging, but there's a lot of neuroscience on habits, addictions, and fears that basically says it's in the brain as a shadow, also for trauma, that if you've had this experience, it's changed you. Addiction changes you. Trauma changes you. Phobias change you. Loss changes you. And that's okay. And what happens when people gain control, so they are no longer controlled by old habits and addictions, it's not like what you see is the trace of it in the brain disappears completely. You do see some neuroplastic changes that help people gain more control over it, or you see that it's less easily triggered. But you also see from the neuroscience that it is quite possible you put people or you put lab animals into a certain context or under a certain amount of pressure, and it gets reactivated. It's still there. And I know that that is discouraging for a lot of people, but I also know that if you've gone through the process of difficult change or recovery from trauma, recovery from addiction, or recovery from grief, you kind of already know this is true. And it's something that you carry with you. And so rather than sort of thinking, oh, we're just going to replace it with a positive new habit, I really think I want to end on this message that is consistent with what we've been talking about, that the wise self cares for all the selves. And even as you develop mindfulness and new positive change, to know that you will carry with you who you've always been and that there needs to be room for that in your experience and to have continuous empathy and compassion for it and to not be surprised if that self shows up again. Because if you're surprised by it, like for me, I fly often, I'll be flying multiple times in a week. And maybe once a year or so, I'll have a panic attack. And it's like, what? But you know what? That's still part of it. That may never go away. And if I were so surprised by it that I believed it, I would be unable to continue to have this relationship of courage to it. So I don't know if that's probably not the answer you were hoping for, but that's the way that I think about these things.
Well, that's the one that you gave, and that will more than suffice. So we've got time for one final question, and to end it on a positive note, can you give us a go-to practice that we might use on a daily basis as we're cultivating this relationship with our wise selves and alignment to our highest goals?
Yep, I'll give you my favorite practice. I've been doing it for years and I still do it every day. First thing before I get out of bed, I ask myself, what's the value I want to remember as I go through today? Now, it took a little bit of time to train myself for that to be the first thing I think and to not get out of bed forgetting to do it. But it's a wonderful exercise that primes you to be that version of yourself throughout the day. And then I also do a review at night because I'm not someone who falls asleep the instant my head hits the pillow. And so I ask myself, how did I live this value today? Or how did I fall short on it today? In a very sort of curious and compassionate way, not a super critical way, just curiosity about it. And that is a practice to think about beginning your day and ending your day, connecting to your value, setting an intention, and then doing a little bit of reflection that I found enormously helpful. And it's something that you can begin tonight when you go to sleep.
Kelly McGonigal, thank you so much for this amazing session.
You're welcome.
This concludes the third live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. Once again, we appreciate Dr. Kelly McGonigal for delivering this outstanding presentation. Please note that the recording of this session will remain accessible for free for 24 hours. And if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, along with bonus gifts from our presenters. I'd also like to thank everyone who joined us today and for submitting your questions, and apologize to those we couldn't get to. We certainly enjoyed having you with us as well. Please join us for our next live session with Dr. Ron Siegel, and that'll take place later today at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. For Sounds True, I'm Christy Peoples. Thank you all for joining us. SoundsTrue.com. Many voices, one journey.